Hello and welcome to another episode of Screen One for LastMovieStanding.com. On the show this week, we have a lady that skates, a ladybird, and a lady who has a thing for ugly looking creatures. To find out what movies I am talking about, stay with us. But first up in Screen One, we take a look at I, Tonya.
The haters always say, Tonya, tell the truth. Tonya, Tonya. There's no such thing as truth. Everyone has their own truth.
I was the best figure skater in the world at one point in time.
You call that a clean skate, for Christ's sake?
Do not swear in front of the kids.
I didn't swear, you cunt.
Who's that?
You two fuck yet?
We need to see a wholesome American family.
I don't have a wholesome American family.
You skated like a graceless bull dyke.
I was embarrassed for you.
My entire life, I'd been told I wouldn't amount to anything. You know what? Maybe I would.
I, Tonya is directed by Craig Gillespie, who I think is starting to build up a quietly solid resume for himself, truth be told. He's done solid films like Lars and The Real Girl and The Finest Hours, but probably I, Tonya is the first time, I think, where he has really shown me something, and I hope he kind of pushes on from here. We will see if he does anyway, because it's getting a lot of traction at the award ceremony, so we'll see if he gets better material to work with from here on. It's got a good cast as well. Margot Robbie, who hasn't really shown me anything up until now, other than the fact that she is extremely beautiful. I think this movie proves that given the right role, she can be a good actress. To clarify, I don't dislike her as an actress. I'm just kind of indifferent. I think she has always had charisma, but she is very good in this role, to be fair. I think it's right that she was given a nomination for this. It feels to an extent, although it's definitely not on the same level by any means, but it feels like a Charlize Theron monster moment, only in the sense that we didn't expect anything from Theron prior to that movie, and now we do. So I do expect more from Margot Robbie after she proved herself here to an extent. The film is also bolstered by other strong casting choices as well. Alison Janney, I've always really liked, and Julian Nicholson stood out in this movie as well to me as her coach. So this movie is a true story, it's biographical, and it's based on the life of a famous figure skater for both bad and good reasons, played by Margot Robbie. It's set in the 80s and 90s. Now, I was familiar with this story, but by the time this movie had come out, I had forgotten it, and all I could really remember about it was the name Tonya Harding. Now, the movie does a number of things right for a biopic. Firstly, it presents everyone to an extent as an unreliable narrator. We get this kind of documentary style account of different people's point of view telling the story. We get Tonya's account mainly, and it is from her perspective mostly, but she is still for sure unreliable as a narrator. We get her husband's account sometimes as well, played by Sebastian Stan, who is probably the weakest actor in this movie. He played the Winter Soldier in Captain America, which makes it kind of funny that this movie is actually written by somebody called Steve Rogers, but there you go. We also get the account of Tonya's mother, played by Allison Janney as well. And man, having an unreliable narrator for a biopic, it's fun. It's actually a great way to go about it. I think from here on out, every biopic should have an unreliable narrator, if it turns out like this, because we get this great, pulpy, trashy approach to really serious stuff that could, in other people's hands, become a real, real drag, considering what is being dealt with here, which I appreciated, and it made it fun, and it made me actually way more emotionally involved with the character of Tonya as well. I don't know if it was because my guard was down, because of how the movie was happy to exploit this material for entertainment, but all the things that were thrown out there in an almost incidental, fun, stylistic, Tarantino-esque way at times do start playing on your conscience without you realizing. I mentioned the Winter Soldier, Sebastian Stan, was the weakest actor in this movie, but it is actually clever casting in a way, considering the conflicting type of narrative we get about his character in this movie. It's kind of like everybody is the hero in their own story, right? You know what I mean? The costumes, the makeup, the period itself were all very well done as well. The sport of figure skating is brought to life in a way that you will appreciate it as well as an art form. If you don't know anything about it, it does all that very well. It's just a fun, entertaining movie about some pretty serious stuff. It's very stylized, very nice camera work. We have characters breaking the fourth wall occasionally. It just feels like a very fresh approach and a nice change of pace from what we normally get. But then the film has this lovely ace up its sleeve, and it has its cake and eats it in a great way. I mean, you're allowed to have your cake and eat it if you can do it like this. There's nothing wrong with that approach. The film and its conflicting narratives, and how we as an audience and everyone else are entertained. And, you know, we had fun passing judgment and trying to figure out who to believe, who we don't, in a very audience type of style of judgment way that we often do as spectators to these things. And it's called out in this movie, and it's called out in this very clever way that hits you on the head without the film ever abandoning its tone. It just gives you that tone in a slightly different context, and it works really well. We see it through the press coverage in this movie and how horrendous this type of snap judgment and talking like we know something about situations that we don't know about it. Let's face it, we are just here to entertain ourselves, gossip, pass judgment, and celebrate hate and misery without knowing the facts. And we kind of dress it up as us being moral guardians, but you know, we all know what it really is. Well, the mirror of the press and the people in this film is turned on us, and then the fourth wall breaks, which were entertaining to begin with, are now speaking directly to us, and that guilt then becomes attached to us and what we are like as a society when it comes to being righteous, when it comes to talking about truth, whatever that is. And when it comes to judgment as well, you know, we treat news stories and figures like they're soap stars. We love to hate and boo and cheer like a immoral jury. And the film allows us to do that in a fun way for most of its runtime and be entertained by it. Then comes that slight tweak and we get a different context to it. I'm not saying this movie is like Natural Born Killers, but it almost bites us with the same type of content without us realizing it. It really sneaks up on us. There was only one thing that I didn't like, and that is when the film gets a character or a voiceover, I can't remember which, to kind of make that literal statement just to make sure everybody got it, even the ones in the back who weren't paying attention. Even though, you know, if you are paying attention, you got it by now. You know what the film was trying to say. So I hate when a statement is made in a very literal sense on what the film has been telling us in every other aspect. I don't like when movies do that. But, you know, other than one or two missteps, I had a really good time with this film, actually. It's worth seeing big time.
If I told you about her, the princess without voice, what would I say?
Eliza, come on. Eliza, hurry.
She deaf?
Mute, sir. She can hear you.
You clean that lab, you get out.
This may very well be the most sensitive asset ever to be housed in this facility.
You may think that thing looks human. Stands on two legs, right? But we're created in the Lord's image. You don't think that's what the Lord looks like, do you?
In Screen 2 this week, we have The Shape of Water, directed by Guillermo del Toro. Somebody asked me recently, was I a fan of Guillermo del Toro's work? And I immediately said yes, but after thinking about it for a while longer, I realised I was saying that I was a fan of Pan's Labyrinth, because if I went through most of his filmography, I would actually say I'm not a fan of his work at all. Crimson Peak, Pacific Rim, Hellboy, Blade 2, The Mimic, I don't like them very much. And I haven't seen Cronus or The Devil's Backbone from what I can remember. So that's one movie out of an entire career, out of however many movies I've seen, that I've actually liked. Now, it just so happens that the one movie I do like, I love, it's one of my favourite movies of all time, so, you know, there is that. But the weird thing is with Pan's Labyrinth is he found a fantastic way to incorporate his love of creature features, Hammer, horror, and all these kind of genres that are kind of, I don't know what the right word is, but I guess to me, he feels like a B-movie director with an imagination of a genius, and perhaps separating him from all those directors, most importantly, I suppose, is an uncanny ability to translate what is in his head and his imagination onto the screen. Because, you know, I'm sure B-movie directors have great imaginations, but translating it onto screen, regardless of the budget, is the biggest test of any artist, and I guess the bigger imagination you have, the bigger test it is to get that vision on screen. But he managed to merge that kind of sensibility with something like Pan's Labyrinth that is just the perfect merging of two things, I feel. I mean, that kind of dark fairy tale being used as a form of escapism for a time in history and in our reality that was dreadful. It's just kind of a genius coming together of two completely different things and styles merging, which is the kind of coming together which is why I love film so much. But I think in general, although I respect the guy immensely and especially his imagination, he kind of, to me anyway, seems like a guy that is more happy and more drawn to that kind of low budget, goofy type of monster movie. Albeit, number one, he takes it completely seriously, and number two, he just has this unique kind of imagination and fuses it with things like Mexican folklore and Victorian aesthetics to make it great. And number three, actually, he's got a big budget for this type of stuff, which really helps with sometimes goofy type of sensibilities. But to me, yeah, he just seems happy to work with goofy material than do another Pan's Labyrinth and push himself. I mean, if he wants to do that, good luck to him. But anyway, The Shape of Water is the first time I have liked a Guillermo del Toro movie for a long time. So I kind of want to see more of this kind of guy rather than a Pacific Rim or a Crimson Peak del Toro, personally. But this is another merging of his sensibilities with something else to elevate it significantly. The Shape of Water is set in a top secret research facility in the 1960s. And it follows a lonely, mute janitor played by Sally Hawkins, who forms a unique relationship with an amphibious creature that is being held in captivity. I guess the most obvious point of reference is the creature from the Black Lagoon. And, you know, Del Toro knows what's up because he said one of the reasons why he set the film during the 1960s Cold War era is to counteract today's heightened tensions. He specifically said, if I say Once Upon a Time in 1962, it becomes a fairy tale for troubled times, people can lower their guard a little bit more and listen to the story and listen to the characters and talk about issues rather than the circumstances of the issues. I think for somebody like me watching a film, it's a good approach, and I lowered my guard. So this film, first and foremost, I think, is a love letter to cinema, and I guess in particular a love letter to the kind of cinema that Del Toro loves, the creature features, silent cinema, horrors. Now, one thing that really annoys me about kind of when directors do these love letter movies to cinema is it never really seems coherent. It kind of feels like just a string of references and tonal changes that never feel like they actually connect together. It's more smile and nod moments. I see kind of, you know, where he's taking that form. It's like breadcrumbs. I mean, as much as I love Hail Caesar, the movie is guilty of it big time. Just these kind of smile and nod references. It can often feel pastiche and nothing more. But with Shape of Water, there is a real fluidity to the things it references that still allows the movie to exist as an entity that stands as a work of art in its own right. If you didn't get the references, it's fine, because the visuals of the story and the references themselves, they're all working with intent, and the intent to service the film. So there are musical moments, dance moments, horror moments, but they're not distractions. They're all in service of the film, and they're working with intent. Well, there is one scene where I think it goes a bit too far, but I can forgive it. Now, the monster to me looked pretty goofy again, but you know, it is the sensibilities of the filmmaker. And when he takes it deadly serious, it works, and we get this lovely kind of beauty and the beast story. Although, curiously, not enough of the relationship is featured as much as I would have liked. I needed more of that and their relationship. I thought that wasn't mined as much as it could be. And although we do get a few nice moments between Sally Hawkins and the monster's relationship, yeah, we don't get enough of it. Del Toro has also said that his views on the horror genre are inherently political. I think he said, like, well, I don't need to think, the quote is right here in front of me, but he said, much like fairy tales, there are two facets of horror. One is pro-institution, which is the most reprehensible type of fairy tale. Don't wander into the woods and always obey your parents. The other type of fairy tale is completely anarchic and anti-establishment. Now, for me, I think the film's biggest fault, and I guess other people will love it, but to me, is that he is too interested in the political aspect at times, that he neglects the story he is telling, and he neglects the actual characters in terms of discussing broader issues and using the monster as a metaphor. And I think that kind of thing can work, but not always. But it works most effectively through strong characters and seeing these issues being played out through the characters and story on a very personal level, not in a kind of broader allegorical sense. Now, it worked in Pan's Labyrinth because there was always two separate elements coexisting: the political, as in the tyranny of a regime, and then the little girl's imagination. In Shape of Water, it touched me more in terms of the political issues when it focused on story. It got me in those scenes big time, but there isn't enough of them, and there are some really clunky attempts on Del Toro's part to put them there at times, not in service of the story, but in a way that took me away from the story, which really annoyed me. The cast is really good. Sally Hawkins, who I got turned on to pretty late in the day actually, is wonderful as this mute character. Michael Shannon, as we know, makes a brilliant bad guy. It's got a very good all-round cast. Michael Stuhlbarg, Richard Jenkins, and Doug Jones as the creature. I mean, Andy Serkis gets the plaudits, and rightly so, but I think Doug Jones, when playing non-human characters, although he doesn't do it with motion capture as often as Serkis does, he does it more with heavy makeup and prosthetics, but he is such an underrated component in all his movies. I think it was an episode of Buffy the Vampire Slayer, actually, where he plays the gentleman. That's when I first became aware of him, but I'm a big fan. But anyway, to conclude with The Shape of Water, I think it is the perfect marriage of Del Toro's sensibilities in some ways, in really effective ways. He has found a way to merge them and utilize them to cross genres. My only main gripe is there wasn't enough urgency in the story. There wasn't enough time devoted to the central relationship in the search of a broader commentary, I suppose, which hurt the film, in my opinion. But it is a massive step up from his recent work, but still a long way behind Pan's Labyrinth, which is probably the best we are going to get from him, maybe.
I hate California. I want to go to the East Coast.
I want to go where culture is, like New York, or at least Connecticut or New Hampshire, where writers live in the woods.
Get into those schools anyway.
Mom!
You should just go to City College. You know, with your work ethic, just go to City College and then to jail, and then back to City College, and then maybe you'd learn to pull yourself up and not expect everybody to do everything.
Lady Bird, is that your given name?
Yeah.
Why is it in quotes?
I gave it to myself. It's given to me by me.
Lady Bird always says that she lives on the wrong side of the tracks, but I always thought that that was like a metaphor. But there are actual train tracks.
What she did was very baller. It was very anarchist.
Put the magazine back!
She has a big heart, your mom.
She's warm, but she's also kind of scary.
You can't be scary and warm.
I think you can. Your mom is.
So, you're not interested in any Catholic colleges?
No way. I want schools like Yale, but not Yale because I probably couldn't get in.
You definitely couldn't get in.
In screen three this week is Lady Bird, directed by Greta Gerwig. And Lady Bird has been a movie I have been really excited for a while now. I love Gerwig as an actor. Love Gerwig as a writer. She's worked with some of the best and in genres I am crazy about, like mumblecore. She has worked with some of my favorite directors, Baumbach, the Duplass brothers, Joe Swanberg, and so on. I figured her movie Lady Bird would exist in that kind of sphere as well, and it does. Except it feels much more polished and assured than most of those filmmakers' other work, actually, who I've just mentioned, especially for a debut feature. It feels remarkably assured, and as a director, like, she's already the finished article. It's impressive. Lady Bird is the kind of movie that makes a better experience than a conversation on a film podcast to dissect, because so much of it is in the characters. It's a coming of age story set in 2002 in Sacramento, and I guess for Gerwig, who is also from there, this movie is at least semi-autobiographical or very strongly drawn from personal experience. I mean, Saoirse Ronan, who plays the 17-year-old girl in this, embodies so much of what a 17-year-old Greta Gerwig would be like, just from taking her persona into account, at least in the films I have seen. She feels like she is playing a version of Greta Gerwig I recognize strongly. The other thing to note is that the characters in this movie, and the main character, in fact, are the same age as I was at the same period. So I had a lot of reference points with the music, and even through the fact the movie is set in a Catholic school. I mean, this movie is set in Sacramento, and I am from Ireland, but it is really weird to watch a coming-of-age story set in the kind of time that you were that age. I think it's the first time I've experienced it. And this story gets adolescence so perfectly that it brought loads of memories flying back. Most I would have rather forgotten, to be honest, just for the cringe factor alone. But that's when you know a film is doing its stuff, I suppose. And it does get that kind of conceited, self-absorbed, you're in your own world, entirely unaware of the problems of others and the proper adults around you. You don't know anything about life, but yet you are just a few months away from being thrown headfirst into it, and you are still years from figuring out who you are, The movie is very funny as well, but it's not funny in that slapstick bound back way. It is much more focused and a much more composed type of film than his work. I can't wait to see what she does next, actually. She could well prove to be better than Baumbach over time, or any of her influences, quite frankly. She really has something. I mean, she's not there yet as a director, but it's a great start, very assured. The real heart of this film is the relationship between Lady Bird and her mother, played by Laurie Metcalf, who I only ever remember from her role in Roseanne. But what a time for her to be given a role to show what she is capable of, because I had no idea that, you know, someone like this could be that good. But her relationship with her daughter is one of the most realistic portrayals of a mother-daughter relationship I have ever seen, or even mother-son too. There is so much of my own relationship with my mother I could recognize from that age. I mean, you both love each other, but you can't communicate, and it's just two strong-willed people who set each other off, basically. But their relationship is a joy to watch, and there is all these real-world problems separate from the adolescent world, so to speak, bubbling under the surface, unbeknownst to your own adolescent self-centeredness. It's so perfectly realized as well. Again, another film with a cast full of bright actors and seasoned character actors as well. Timothy Chalamet plays a real douche in this that is almost the polar opposite to his Call Me By Your Name character. And what an actor that guy will be. I mean, you can really see the contrast between those two movies. He's a very good actor. Lucas Hedges, another very good up-and-coming actor. Tracy Letts, great character actor. Stephen Henderson, who was in Fences, is good here as well. There is a final scene in this movie that I am kind of bursting to talk about, but I won't, because, you know, spoilers. But it perfectly signifies that kind of jump from a teenager to an adult in the most perfectly realized and articulated way imaginable. It's just such a simple scene that demonstrates the first time your actions really just fall back on you. There is no one else to care for you and pick up the pieces. You're on your own. The inclusion of that scene really hits home in both the character and the audience, the theme of this movie, in such a devastating way. I mean, the fact Gerwig had the intelligence as a filmmaker to include it really makes me excited to see what she does next. I know I'm not really doing this film the justice it deserves, but it is more of an experience than something to break down critically. And it is an experience I would definitely urge you all to seek out, because I thought it was very good. Okay, that brings us to the end of the show this week. Please follow me on Twitter at AndyTalksFilm. I just want to quickly mention another very good podcast I'm involved in called Around the World in 80 Movies, which I host alongside film critic Michael Lennon. Each episode, we are in a different country. We've done Ireland, Wales. So next week's episode, we will be in England. And the movie that will be discussed by Michael is Kes. That podcast is Around the World in 80 Movies. Have a look for it. Okay, that's it. Good luck and goodbye.